The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
Good morning and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show here on 1310 KFKA. Welcome to the show today. This is a live recorded show. This is October 3rd, 2015. That's when the show is going to play for the first time. My name is Chris Stein, a certified financial planner and a finance instructor at Colorado State University. And I'm joined here. We are quasi-live in studio with Jim Saulnier, also a certified financial planner. Good afternoon, Jim.
Good afternoon slash morning.
Yes. And Peter Scott Esquire.
Good morning.
Is here as well. And good afternoon. This is a, like I said, a live recorded show. So no live calls today.
Well, you can call live, just won't be anyone answering it.
You always say that.
I know.
Somebody's going to answer.
There's someone there.
At the station almost all the time.
No, there's no one there right now. We're not there.
They're there.
No, they're not. There's nothing playing from 9 to 11 when we're there. Not there. or 8 to 10, whatever time we
Adrian
play.
Is there while the show is playing.
No, he's not.
And if the phone is... Yeah, he is.
No, I think it's all in a computer.
No? It's in the computer, but there's someone there.
Adrian just sits there for 2 hours doing nothing.
Yep.
That's a sweet gig.
Well, sounds kind of boring to me, but...
I don't think there's anyone there.
I'm pretty sure there's someone there.
I'm going to call Saturday morning.
You should and see if someone answers. They might just... They'll see it's you. and not answer, but I'm pretty sure if anybody else
What are you
calls,
trying to say?
Well, you've called them so many times with bogus voices.
Well, that, he still picks up the phone.
Yeah, I know.
That's usually why we're in the studio. That right. Chip does that. So right. It's not like Adrian can't see him.
Right. The trick works every time.
Well, I do want to, in case we say something strange.
In case?
Well, yeah. When we say something strange during the show today, I want everybody to realize that our schedule is a little different this week. We're actually recording this a little ways ahead. This is September 22nd for us. So when Jim said good afternoon, this is the afternoon of the September 22nd. This show will play on October 3rd, and we just had to do that due to some timing issues.
Right, because I will not be here next week.
Right.
I will be in Boston for the FPA conference, and then I'm going to spend a week visiting family. You and Pete next week, which would be the 26th.
Which will be last week for the people listening to this.
Yes, that's right. Last week. Last week, you guys did a Social Security trivia show. How'd it go?
I think we did.
That's what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah. I don't have much of a remembrance of that.
Well, no.
It must be the early onset of Alzheimer's.
So,
and then next week...
Next week, the 10th of October.
We will be live with our special guest who we'll introduce in one short moment.
We have a special guest 2 weeks in a row?
We do. She's here today,
wow.
As you know, because you can see her right across the table from you.
Well, I know, but I'm...
And then she will be here next
radio
week,
drama.
Which is actually 3 weeks from now, but next week
October
from when this
10th.
Is playing. You confused? Because I'm totally
You're
confused.
You're really, yeah.
Yes. So, but by time people hear this, real people,
right.
This will be October 3rd.
Today
the following week is October 10th.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Our special guest will be live in studio taking listeners' questions, of which we hope there's many.
Yes. And so as a result of today's show, save your questions and you can call in on October the 10th and get a live answer.
Right. Or you can email them to me. As some of our listeners know by now, they can email questions. So any question that may arise after listening to today's show, which is going to touch upon senior issues, Medicaid, maybe some Medicaid, I don't quite know. But we hope to cover a lot of senior issues, Chris, that you were saying we don't regularly cover on this show. And if it generates any type of questions, we're going to have our special guest live in studio on October 10th from 8 to 10 answering your listeners' questions. And if you know anything about attorneys, they charge for every single bit of time. So the fact that we're going to be able to have two attorneys in studio live for free.
For free, yes.
I mean, that's amazing. My attorney, if I say God bless you, I get a $38 bill. So the idea is to call if you have any questions about any of the topics that we're going to talk about today. And I assume they're going to generate a lot because it is a topic, Pete, that is very, very important.
Well, it is. And as our population ages, the baby boomers are entering their senior years. There's more and more of the population that are facing these unique issues of the elderly, elderly being defined as you see it fit, but nonetheless, Medicare, Medicaid, health care, powers of attorney, things like that. And we have with us in studio today, as Jim and Chris have mentioned, we have Jan Lord, an attorney in Berthoud, Colorado.
Fine place to be, I might add.
Yes, I think I've heard of it.
Yes.
It's come up on the show a number of times. They have no mosquitoes there, as I understand it.
Not at least around my house. But so, it is a massive metropolis.
Yes. And so Jan's office is in Berthoud, and her area of concentration and specialization, I guess we're not allowed to say that.
Actually,
knowledge.
We can. Okay. We can say that now.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So she works she does estate planning and has a concentration in the specific issues of the elderly with their health and their Medicaid qualification, long-term care, all of those things. And I use Jan extensively for that. I don't do that kind of work, so I have great people that I refer to. And Jan does a fine job and is just a lot of fun to work with besides that. So welcome, Jan.
Thank you very much. What a pleasure and an honor. And I'm a little humbled with this group, awesome group we have.
Humbled?
Whoa. I thought you said she listened to the show before, Peter.
I thought she had.
Maybe I'll get over it.
Starstruck, of course.
So do you have a physical office there in Berthoud?
I do, with the... yep. 1201 Lake Avenue. I'm right inside the Adams Bank building, right inside the front door on the west end of town.
Is that close to, people in Berthoud probably know where it is, but... Isn't there a restaurant right by there that's fairly popular?
Not on that location.
Maybe I'm thinking of a different bank.
Taft coming south from Loveland crosses mountain.
We have some great restaurants in town, though, and would welcome you coming by for dinner at any of them.
All 5,000 of us would welcome you.
All 5,000 Berthoudians?
Berthoudians, yes.
Okay. Is that what we determined their label should be?
I know we discussed it. I think, Berthoudian sounds biblical, though.
How about Berthuds?
A reading from the book of Berthoudians.
Berthuds?
Or how about Berthites?
Berthoudite.
Berthoudite.
Sounds a little bit like troglodyte.
Yeah, I like Berthoudians. That makes us sound really elegant.
Well, that doesn't fit then.
But,
so now we've lost all of our listeners in Berthoud.
Yeah. All of them are now very angry at you.
No, I was referring mainly to you, Jim.
Excuse me?
The elegant piece. Well, you do have a new wardrobe, though.
Yes.
Although it looks very much like your old wardrobe now.
It's a wardrobe for radio, I think.
Yeah. So it doesn't look good?
I'm just saying. It's a wardrobe for radio.
Like it.
Yeah.
It's just a shirt.
So did your
rent? Why no? Does your rent-a-wife realize that you've gone back to your old...
A relapse.
No, isn't this an old outfit?
Well, it's a year old. Is that old?
Well, is that part of your new getup from the...
It's one of my new shirts I bought a while ago.
Okay. Do you ever put on the old stuff, or did you throw it all away?
No, I still have some of it.
Hmm. Okay.
Boy, in a common law jurisdiction, the idea of a rent-a-wife sounds pretty fascinating, but...
Apparently, you don't listen enough to understand what my rent-a-wife is. She's a woman who buys my clothes.
I've been told. Yes. I've been told.
We've all heard about it. Yeah. Right. So do we have any, we can't do any housekeeping from last week because we don't know what happened last week, because last week is next week for us, and it's a mystery.
But it should have been.
Because we normally clean up any loose ends from the previous week, so previous
next
week.
Next week, which is last week, should have been a Social Security trivia show.
So do you want to anticipate any loose ends that we might have from that future show?
No, I think you and Pete, because I'm not going to be there running a very smooth show. So I think both of you will do a fine job without me.
Well, I do know we'll probably be done early.
This seems like an episode of Back to the Future.
It does,
with
doesn't
IRA
it?
Right. And retirement
yes.
planning.
It is a little bit.
Just be forewarned. I will be listening.
To what?
The show. I'll be in Boston, but I'm going to have wireless headphones on, a little ear things.
You have nothing better to do than eavesdrop on our
maybe I'll
simple
call
discussion?
In with some of the answers.
Okay, we'll see. I'll write some special questions just for you, Jim.
Okay. But anyways, Jan, I wanted to thank you for coming. I've been hoping to get you on for a while and help us cover some topics that we don't cover enough on the show. So why don't you describe a little bit about your background, your practice, and your areas of specialization, and then we can segue into, really, we have no script. We're just going to kind of hit you from the hip with some questions. And the course of today's show will just follow whatever direction it goes. That's why we call live recorded radio. There'll be no takes. So if you muff up, it's going to play.
Shoot, then aim.
Shoot,
aim,
fire.
Think of it as a form of cross-examination.
I'm in.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm in.
Okay. Fire, ready, aim.
I've been practicing law in excess of 30 years. I'm not quite as old as Peter.
Wow.
But we've been busy and been privileged to practice law for that amount of time. However, about 17 years of that time has been in the elder law area. Any attorney who says they practice elder law probably has their own definition of what that means. And early on in my elder law work, I did do a lot of litigation, probate litigation, guardianship, conservatorship, contested issues between parents and what might otherwise be called EACs, evil adult children. but since as I got into it, I discovered I really enjoyed more of what's called the transactional work and the planning work, and feel like I could be a lot more helpful being proactive and feel better about being proactive than cleaning up messes. So in litigation, so I really focus now on a lot of the things that I think you and your financial planning work focus on, and that's helping people think realistically about what's going to happen not only when they die, which is the traditional notion of estate planning, but also what's going to happen if they become disabled. Who's going to look after them and help make decisions for them if they're unable to make those decisions on their own? And then secondly, as people age and their care needs grow, so does the bill that for paying for those needs. So I really do emphasize thinking about long-term care in terms of decision-making as well as in terms of your finances and how are we going to pay for this. So that's where my practice has evolved, and frankly, that's where I get the most joy.
So let me ask you, for the novices amongst us or those listening, what confuses me is Peter has many hats he wears, but he is an estate planning attorney. And I'm sure a lot of estate planning attorneys out there say, oh, yes, I can do elder planning, or I'm an elder attorney, or I do estate planning. And a lot of people might think they're interchangeable. But Pete said he sends a lot of clients your way, so clearly it's telling me it's not interchangeable. So how would both of you describe the differences yet similarities between an estate planning attorney and an elder care attorney or an elder law attorney?
Well, I'll pick it up from there. I made a decision quite a few years ago not to pursue the elder law, as it's become known, areas of practice, which would deal with long-term care, Medicaid qualification, Medicare issues, those sorts of unique things that the elderly deal with. Now, the estate planning brush that I painted with is really more about planning for disability, incapacity in a non-governmental supported or funded situation, and dealing with it privately within the family. And that, and also in terms of the tax planning and all of that, which has become less of an issue, thankfully, as a result of the relatively new laws. So I draw the line when I have someone whose capacity is diminished and they're concerned about qualifying for public benefits, Medicaid primarily, and that's when I will refer them to Jen. Now, it, usually from that point, she will go ahead and do the traditional estate planning for them as well as the financial planning, and I don't mean the financial planning that Jim, you, and Chris do, but more the financial planning to arrange things so that people can qualify for the public benefits, preserve assets, that sort of thing, to make sure that they have the resources available either publicly or privately to pay for their own care in for the rest of their lives.
And along those lines, what Peter knows but didn't share is that he knows enough to know about what he doesn't know. And so there, honestly, I feel that any estate planning attorney has a responsibility, whether or not the Office of Regulation Counsel would impose that. But I think any estate planning attorney should know the danger areas where their work with a client could compromise an elderly client or a potentially disabled client's future eligibility for Medicaid. So if assets are being moved around or transferred within 5 years of potentially needing some kind of long-term care service, then we may have a problem with ultimate qualification for Medicaid. And frankly, estate planners fall into that trap. They might utilize a life estate deed on a home, or they might encourage some gifting from the client to adult children or grandchildren or something along those lines. And if that is done without a view forward of what might happen in 5 years, without paying attention to those potential consequences, the estate planning attorney may have hindered the ability to get a client ultimately qualified for Medicaid long-term care benefits.
Interesting, because we talk, Chris, sometimes on our show, how both of you are saying you know what you don't know. We talk openly sometimes in our industry. There's a lot of advisors. Of course, we've mentioned before the barriers to entry in my industry are far lower than the barriers to entry in your industries. But we often talk about advisors who don't know what they don't know, and they're the most dangerous.
They're scary.
So I would imagine it would be the same thing with some attorneys who try practicing in an area where they might dabble but not fully know.
Well, and I would agree with that. You're looking at Chris, but I would agree. Yeah. And one of the reasons that I elected not to practice in the elder law area, in addition to many others, is if the laws, and not so much the laws, but the regulations that come out of the administrative bodies that write the regulations for interpretation of these laws change very rapidly. And if you're not engaged in that area of law on a daily basis, you're not going to be able to keep up. And I've got my hands full with my practice just keeping up with it, let alone taking on another practice. So that was something that I elected not to do. So anyway, you have to be involved daily because mm-hmm. it changes, and it's not always logical changes.
Mm-hmm. Oh. And are there a lot of, I guess, practicing elder law specialists, or is this a fairly new or small niche?
I think that the area is definitely growing. 15 years ago, 16, 17 years ago, you could probably count on two fingers the elder law practitioners, legal practitioners in this state, and that I think one of the founders would be Martha Ridgway, and then another Denver attorney whose name is Eric Solem, both of whom were what I would call old legal services lions, working in the public benefits area through the program for the poor, the civil legal assistance for the poor called Legal Services. But since for the last 15, 20 years, with the growing aging population, of course, the service industry, including yours, has grown around it. So there are more and more and more elder law attorneys, many of whom are just frustrated litigators who wanted something more out of life.
Hmm. Interesting.
Well, why don't we start today's conversation again, because it's really an open mic type discussion I want to have today. In your practice, Jan, what would the three most common either fears clients have or issues clients have that you regularly deal with. And let's walk through those and maybe expand upon them a little and see where the conversation goes.
Sure.
But what are some of the biggest reasons people come see you?
Well, the first, typically what happens is there's a crisis. Mom or dad or spouse has entered the nursing home. The Medicare coverage for a period of rehabilitation, which is up to 90 days, has ended. So the bills which were being picked up by Medicare through the Medicare health insurance piece has have now started coming directly to the individual, to the client, and those bills look something like $8,000-$9,000 a month, and they take one look at what they have in savings, they take a look at the future and how long mom or dad or husband might be in the nursing home or even in an assisted living setting, and there is fear. What can we do about this? So that the first question, I guess, is how are we going to pay for long-term care under these extreme circumstances with these high, high monthly bills?
Okay.
The second kind of planning, and once the elder, once the parent is in the office, what they are worried about is they don't want to be a burden. And so there's a fair amount of work that has to be done. Typically, if we're talking about the greatest generation, these are very proud, as you know, very dignified in their thinking, very independent, even though they are frail. And they are worried that they are going to become a burden even as they are losing their independence. They're worried that they can't drive anymore or that their kids are going to take away their car keys. So there's any number of fears that they might have that just come as we age and our worlds literally get smaller. The other thing that they are typically worried about is they want to leave something for their kids. Something for their kids. They are less likely to spend money on themselves. They won't naturally, as a rule, pay for the care they need when they need it, so that if we could maintain them in the home with a little bit of help, with someone coming in, helping with meals, that kind of thing, helping with house cleaning, a little bit of transportation assistance, one thing or another, they might be able to stay home longer. But that, again, that independence gets in the way. And bottom line is they find themselves in the crisis kind of situation, and they're worried that they may not be able to leave something for their kids or their grandkids after they die.
And I would imagine at that point what's going through your mind, because it's going through my mind, it's probably going through Pete's mind. I would assume yours too, Chris. Although sometimes I'm not quite sure what goes through your mind.
Very complex and interesting things.
<Yes. laughs> Is you're probably sitting there, Jane, saying, Jan,
there it was.
I knew I was going to do it.
Mm-hmm. It's really okay. I was warned.
Oh, good. Names stump me at times.
Yeah, me too.
Anyway, I knew it was Jane.
Me too, John.
Thank you. Is you're probably sitting there saying, now is too late. Where were you a year ago or 2 years ago or 3 years ago? People put the planning off, and they often put off planning that's the most uncomfortable for them to talk about and come to discuss with others. And that would clearly be their own incapacitation or their own passing probably.
That may cross my mind, but I really feel like even under those circumstances, even in that crisis circumstance, I can offer some hope.
There is some hope.
Yep.
Good.
And under most circumstances, there are some things we can do to make sure that they are safe at home, that they aren't a burden, and that they can leave something for their kids.
Perfect. So when we come back, we're going to give a little hint for the number one song in America 80 years ago, a number one song in America 80 years ago, and we'll pick up where Jan left off.
Right. So this is the Retirement IRA Show. We've posed some interesting, I guess, some interesting setup questions here, and we'll get deeper into this. Once again, we are not live today, but if you have a question on any of the topics that we are discussing today, don't hesitate to shoot us an email. Jim@jimhelps.com is probably the quickest and easiest
and
way to contact
next
us.
Week.
And we can answer it
we'll
the
have
following
Jan
week.
Answer it, yes.
Correct. Or you can go to the website, just jimhelps.com. That's jimhelps.com. On there, you can find the contact us button and find a way to contact Peter or Jim or myself.
And we'll direct
Jan's
Jan.
Not on there, but we can forward something to Jan as well. So here's the hint for the song 80 years ago this week. This song was considered an important composition in the development of jazz, originally written in 1905, but not popular until its reintroduction in 1935. So we'll find out what song that is when we come back from this short break. Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. Enjoying one of the top hits from 1935, 80 years ago. Happens to be the same year that Social Security was started. That's the reasoning behind us playing a song from 80 years ago. We're kind of celebrating the start of a... I don't know what adjectives I want to put on this. Some people love the program, some people don't love the program. Let's say a very significant federal program.
Social Security.
Still around today. Mm-hmm. Yes.
You can say it.
I'm not avoiding saying the word Social Security. I'm using adjectives to describe it. I was choosing my adjectives carefully.
Because it is radio.
I didn't want to say glorious. That might be, you know.
I like it.
I don't
it.
Know if it's glorious.
It's phenomenal.
It's who?
Who?
It's good.
Okay.
That's what I thought you said.
Just clarifying. Yeah. Do you suppose they have the equivalent of Social Security in Belarus?
They may. Hmm. We'll find out from a Belarusian listener.
We should ask them.
Once she gets all my gifts.
Yeah. So that song from 80 years ago, would like to take a guess of what that is?
Pete threw Jan under the bus and wants her to guess.
Oh, yeah, that's right, Jan. You were supposed to guess the name and or artist.
Drawing a blank.
Sounded like, well, it's got a clarinet in it, so it could be Benny Goodman and...
Ooh,
the other one was...
It is Benny Goodman, so he's okay. Halfway
all
there.
Right. Ooh, I'm off the hook now. I'm retiring.
Who's the trumpet player, Pete?
I think it was Satchmo. Yeah.
That is the King Porter Stomp, performed by Benny Goodman. Written by Jelly Roll Morton.
Oh, Jelly
yeah.
Roll?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You've never heard of Jelly Roll Morton?
No, was he a heavyset gentleman?
Not to my knowledge, but he possible.
He liked pastries a lot, I know.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, jelly donuts.
And he named the song for his friend and fellow piano player, Porter King. Thus, the King Porter Stomp. Get it? Ah, a little play on words there. Although the song was written in 1905, copyrighted and played during the 1920s, it was Benny Goodman who made it a big band era standard. Starting
classic.
In 1935.
1935. Yeah. Excellent. Well, we do that all as a lead up to what's new on Help With My Social Security. Mm-hmm.
And the trouble is we can't do that this week, but we can lead up to it. We'll just... skip over that part when we get there.
Why, we don't have a blog post?
Because this is in the future. We don't know what the blog post is, so we can't reflect back and tell them what's on this week because we haven't done it yet.
True.
We're in that weird time warp thing.
We're in that two-week recording thing.
Mm-hmm. This is why we don't normally do this.
This is why we usually go a week out. All right, gotcha. Right. Okay.
But we can maybe throw out a fun fact about Social Security or something. I don't know.
A tip, trick, or strategy?
Just a fun fact.
All right, we'll throw out a fun fact. You have fun facts handy?
No, but I have two more segments to acquire.
Maybe I'll tell a retirement joke.
Oh, my goodness. That comes in the last segment. Let's do the build-up first, and then we can...
Well, I got an email here of the top 30 retirement jokes. Maybe I'll read them.
Who sends out an email of the top 30 retirement jokes?
I don't know. One of the companies I pay attention to. 31, not top 30. 31 of the best retirement jokes.
So like 31 flavors?
Baskin-Robbins.
Mm-hmm.
Of
so
retirement jokes?
We'll do a retirement joke. That's what we'll lead into. I'll open it up.
I just clarify, it's not we. Jim is going to do a retirement joke. I don't want to be painted with this.
Well, no, maybe I should say, as I tried opening the website, I got an error message, website cannot be opened. So we may not be able to do the top 31 retirement jokes.
So the joke may be on you.
We'll try to fix that technical glitch by the time we need it.
No, Safari cannot open the page because it cannot connect.
Oh, that's
Do we have
troubling.
Internet?
We do, because I am using it, but maybe we can try it later.
Well,
so
no joke.
Continuing from our discussion prior to this past break and our enjoyment of the song from 80 years ago, Jim,
I don't think
how
we have
would
you
like to proceed from here? Don't stop panicking. Let's return to the radio show.
Well, nothing's working on my internet. You sure we have internet?
We do have internet. You don't have internet, apparently. But
you know what it is? I updated the software on my iPad.
Oh, that was a huge mistake.
Yeah, don't ever do that.
Your iPad has now become obsolete.
It does. Apple does that on purpose, I swear.
Not a conspiracy theory or anything, but...
I'm going to reboot my iPad.
Okay, you work on that while we move ahead with our discussion about elder topics. With Jan Lord, who's joining us as our guest this week, and will be with us next week as well, live, to answer your questions. So
so she left off with three issues.
Three issues that are common, that are brought to her. And it sounds like she's normally contacted at the time of crisis or at the time of urgency for most people. So what can we do? So you have the first one where they've... Essentially, you were describing the situation where somebody has reached that transition from Medicare, where Medicare has reached that limit, which comes very quickly after 90 days of rehabilitation after they've left a hospital. And that's, people may or may not know that rule. We don't have to delve into that greatly, but that is that not true, where that only kicks in and that is only viable if they go directly from the hospital to the nursing facility?
Right, and they need to be admitted to the hospital, not this emergency room treatment. They need to be admitted to the hospital. I believe it's three overnights, three midnights, which will trigger the Medicare, hospital coverage and the follow-up rehab coverage if in-facility rehabilitation is needed.
And that may not necessarily mean three midnights in the hospital. It means they have to be admitted, which is a formal administrative process where they can be there for observation for three nights and they have not been admitted. So people need to be aware of that.
They do. There have been some efforts to make sure that folks are aware of what's happening so that they can make a request or an appeal for that admission. But the admission and the three overnights as part of the admission are a key to getting that ultimate Medicare coverage.
Is there some sort of penalty to the hospital for admitting someone? Are they in the hook for some charges or something? Is there a reason they would be resistant to a formal admitting process?
If Medicare is, my understanding is, and this is not an area in which I focus a lot, but my understanding is that if the admission does not meet certain criteria through Medicare, that Medicare will not cover it. And as a result, the hospital is looking at a private pay status, which may result in a business loss to the hospital. So I think they're really trying to make sure that they hit all fours with the Medicare admission so that they have some ability to be paid.
Right. So we have an individual who has done that part, gone on to the nursing facility for 90 days, and now that time limit has expired, and they are at the point of loss of coverage from Medicare. And then there's the question of, will Medicaid kick in? And Medicaid, being completely different than Medicare, has a qualification process. And that's really the crux of the issue here. They're calling you. What can we do at this point? So maybe you can describe for us what are the basic qualifications for transitioning from Medicare to Medicaid?
So Medicaid is a needs-based, financial needs-based public benefit program. And let's be really sure that we're differentiating between Medicaid health insurance versus Medicaid long-term care benefits. Colorado has opted in under the Affordable Care Act for Medicaid health insurance for folks who are under, I believe, the age is 55. So I get a lot of questions about Medicaid health insurance And again, my area of expertise is more in the line of Medicaid long-term care benefits. There are three questions that a Medicaid application, they're very lengthy applications, and there's a lot of documentation that is required to go along with the application, but it really boils down to three questions. The first of which is medical. Are you sick? Are you sick enough to really need this benefit? Mm-hmm. Then the second question is, are you poor? And that question is broken down into, and that's my brush mm-hmm. on the qualification, the financial qualifications.
They don't literally ask, are you poor?
They don't. No. But if you take a look at what the financial criteria are, it's broken into two areas. Income, they want to see what the applicant's income is. If there's a married couple and one of the spouses will continue to live at home, what Medicaid calls the community spouse, the community spouse's income is not considered as part of the Medicaid application for what they call the institutionalized spouse. So they look at the applicant's income, but they look at the household resources. So if we have a married couple in Larimer County, there is a threshold income amount of about $2,199.
Let me interrupt you right there, because we have listeners throughout Colorado, but also the internet, and as we're finding, the world.
Yes,
we have Belarus. A Belarusian, we have an Australian. Yep. And
far-reaching.
Japan.
Japanese person.
Australia. Orangutan. What was that?
Australian. Mm-hmm. I put a little too many R's in there. Mm-hmm. But so we're all over. So what you're getting at is, no matter where people are listening to throughout the country, their respective states, Medicaid.
Counties.
Counties would. So everyone's is different depending on where you live.
That's a really good point, Jim.
Thank you.
The Medicaid program is different from state to state to state. So in California, they even call it something different. They call it Medi-Cal. But because each state has the ability to request waivers from the federal government, they can, in effect, each state can tweak their program. So what might be true in Larimer County, and the numbers I'm about to share are strictly in our county here, Larimer County, Fort Collins, Berthoud, Loveland. But they could be different in Boulder County, and they are different in Boulder County.
And we're broadcasting out of Weld County.
Yeah, there you go. So actually, Weld County is included in the same region for Larimer County. So you're right. Weld and Larimer are in the same region. But what we might be talking about in terms of the kind of planning that I can do and that any Colorado elder law practitioner who ventures into this area could do is going to be different than what can happen in Wyoming, what can happen in Nebraska across the state line, okay, in Kansas, et cetera.
So if you're listening to us off of iTunes, a lot of what you say may vary based on their state's rules.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay.
Absolutely.
Gotcha.
Thanks for making that clarification, yeah. Mm-hmm. So we look first at income, mm-hmm, and there's an initial income threshold of $2,199. It's gross. It includes that Medicare premium. They want to know gross amounts. So if you've got a pension and before the pension check is cut, there are some withholdings, Medicaid needs to know the gross income.
And is this of the family or just the spouse that needs the help?
Just the applicant who is sick.
So this is sometimes referred to as the name on the check. Assuming there's a check.
Correct, yeah. Okay. Sometimes it's called the name on the check rule. Yeah. Yep.
And it's the gross amount.
The gross amount. So, for example, in Larimer County, with the use, of a form, basically, that the state Medicaid folks, we call them Healthcare Policy and Financing, HICPUF, that they have put out a little income trust, a form that can, in effect, raise the income eligibility amount in four different regions in the state. And we are in, that is Larimer and Weld County, along with several others. We can raise that gross income limit to $7,286 a month. That figure represents the average cost of nursing home care determined by state Medicaid in that region. So the thinking there is that if you, the applicant, earn $1 more than the average cost of nursing home care within your region, then you can afford to pay for your own nursing home costs, and you're presumptively...
So I guess the assumption there is, since that they take care of all of your needs there, the your housing and food and medication and everything, that as long as you can afford that, you're taken care of, I guess, in quotes, in air quotes. Is that kind of the thought process?
That's it.
There?
I wouldn't say that they take care of all of your needs, right, but they take care of basic.
So
needs.
Who? Now I'm right. getting a little confused because what you're talking about right now is the income eligibility test of the applicant.
I am. Mm-hmm.
And you said a gross amount of $2,199, meaning if they had pension income of, or Social Security income of $1,000 or $1,200 or even $2,000 a month, they could still qualify for some type of governmental assistance. But if they had $2,300 a month, that puts them above this income cap. And are you saying, therefore, they would not qualify for any type of governmental assistance, or they then look to see if they live in some of these other areas where the cap is higher?
They would not qualify unless they utilize something called an income trust. And the purpose of the income trust is, in a nursing home setting, it has very little utility. But if we were in an assisted living type setting, what Medicaid is trying to do is make sure that any funds that they expend on behalf of the individual can ultimately be paid back. And so the trust, if it holds on to any of the applicant's income, let's say that they're in an assisted living setting, the cost of care is $3,000 a month, and the applicant's income is $3,500 a month, then the trustee of that trust is required to maintain that extra income in the trust and account for it later when Medicaid wants a reckoning.
So backing up for a minute, if an individual utilizes the income trust, what they essentially do, and I think the trust gets set up through the courts, if I'm correct or not.
Not anymore, Peter.
Okay.
There is a different trust called a disability trust that might be used for that. But this is from the Miller decision.
Right. Right.
So the Miller trust is something that we can set up privately.
Okay. So just so everybody puts this in context, is if someone wanting to utilize this, they don't have enough income to pay for their own care, but they have too much to qualify for Medicaid, and it used to be called Utah Gap, as I recall.
I was going to ask if that's the Utah Trust I used to hear about.
It's the Utah Gap.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so what the Medicaid or the courts have allowed them to do is to channel all of their income into this trust with a trustee. The trustee then will retain any amounts not paid to the nursing home, and any money left over at that person's death then defaults to
Medicaid.
The Medicaid
That's
program.
It. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thanks,
so
Peter.
If you have more than the $2,199, the applicant we're talking, has more income than that, they could still qualify, but they have to use this income trust, which essentially will ensure any excess money not used to cover that person's care will reimburse Medicaid for any money that the taxpayers have expended providing for their care.
And so someone who refuses to set up the trust for some reason will be faced with the $2,199 limit on qualification. Is that
correct,
essentially what's going on?
Or a denial of Medicaid.
Or a denial
Got
of
it.
Medicaid.
And
okay.
then if they have over the $7,000 or whatever, then they can't even use the income trust, correct?
Unless they move to a different region with a higher income. Higher income.
So, could
limit.
Somebody in Weld County then just move to Boulder County?
Absolutely, mm-hmm. and it happens.
Okay.
Hmm.
And then, so based on each county, will be this maximum amount. You're saying Larimer County is 7,000 and change.
7,286, and over in Region 1, which is, again, our metro counties, Adams, Arapahoe, Boulder, Broomfield, Denver, and Jeffco, that upper limit is $8,039 a month. This doesn't mean that they have to move and buy a home in Boulder County. It just needs they just need to be in a facility in Boulder County.
Hmm. Okay. Okay.
A facility that accepts Medicaid in Boulder County.
Are there any?
There's a kicker there. Right?
Yeah, that's the hot
because
part.
Isn't there a shortage or a limitation on the number of Medicaid beds at these facilities around the state?
There is a huge shortage with assisted living facilities. Hmm. The nursing home facilities are still, at least in our area, we still have beds available. We still have that flexibility. Hmm. The metro creep and closing down of those options is here, but it is not pervasive.
Okay.
So in our Weld County, Larimer County region, we really are in a very nice place for doing this kind of planning. Okay.
But that's for nursing care,
nursing
not
home.
Nursing
assisted
home
living is still a challenge.
Tight. Okay. Got it.
And so what we're talking about, folks, for all our listeners, again, if you're listening to us off of iTunes, we like our TuneIn listeners.
I thought you were going to say our TuneIn lizards.
It was coming out.
We call them
iTunians, don't we?
First I've heard of that, but iTunians?
Didn't we have a whole show we're trying to figure out what to call our iTunes listeners? They're a feisty group, I used to say.
Yes, they are. Yeah.
iTunians?
Okay, well, let's go with that.
Yeah, I like it. You like iTunians, Jen?
Works.
Yeah, iTunians.
Okay.
Okay, so for our iTunian listeners, depending on what state you're in, your rules may be different. But for our Northern Colorado listeners, this is bringing up a lot of thoughts going through my mind. My little chipmunk is running on my wheel right now in my head because I run into this a lot, and I want to kind of carry this conversation. Jan, please correct me if I'm not explaining this to our listeners correctly. What you're talking about is you could have a single person or, in this case, a couple. Somebody needs medical assistance. They have become aged. They're aging. They cannot carry on with caring for themselves. They don't have any long-term care insurance. They got precious little in assets. So now they're turning to governmental assistance. In my practice, I call that societal assets, assets that society has deemed someone may be eligible for based on a certain core group of circumstances. And you're trying to lay out the scenario of when someone may be able to qualify for assistance and may not. And what you're saying is one of the items that they do look at is income. How much income are these people receiving? So let's stop right there first and define income. Are we talking income for Social Security purposes? In other words, distributions from retirement accounts, distributions from annuities, distributions from Roth IRAs, would those be included? Pensions? Or is it everything all the way from capital gains and interest on a bank CD? Or are there some income streams that aren't covered?
Well, first of all, let me correct one thing you said just a moment ago. They may be on claim for long-term care insurance, and the long-term care insurance payments are not income. So in a situation where you have someone on claim for long-term care, but it's not covering
the cost of care,
mm-hmm. then they can still be on Medicaid, and what's coming in from long-term care will not count toward income.
Is that even if it's not a partnership plan?
Especially if it's not a partnership plan. Perfect. And we won't be on Medicaid if the partnership plan has been used, right? Because what happens then is you have to exhaust the partnership benefit, and what the partnership benefit then allows is an increase mm-hmm. in the resource limit. So I could be wrong here, but in a quick thought about it, my guess is that we have exhausted the partnership plan. But in a traditional long-term care type plan where someone may be on claim, but they're only getting $80 a day, which is woefully inadequate, but maybe was the best they had, then we can still get them qualified for Medicaid under other circumstances.
So besides income from a long-term care policy, is there any other type of income that doesn't count towards this $2,199 limit?
Before we go there, I think you probably need to explain partnership, because that's a new term that's thrown out that has not been explained. So I think that at least some point you need to come back to that.
Yeah, and we'll have to do that after the break, because we've got about just over a minute left.
Okay.
So maybe we should pick up with that thought when we come back. How about that?
We can.
Why don't we take this opportunity for Jan to divulge how people can get a hold of her if they want to contact her directly.
Well, thanks. Our law office phone number is 970-532-4183. I also have a website, cjlordlaw.com. That's www.cjlordlaw.com. And the number is 970-532-4183.
She should get Lord Helps.
Yes. L-O-R-D, by the way.
Oh, Lord help me.
those might be registered already. The Pope may have those.
The Pope may have
those. So we're coming up to this next break here on the Retirement and IRA Show. We'll be back with some more information. This is great info from Jan Lord today. And when we come back, we're going to hear the number one song this week in 1975. So 40 years ago this week. The hint is the number one song from this past week, looking back on this song, this writer/singer admits that he was in a period of, quote, pain and anger over mismanagement of his career and money. The resulting song was written with a bit of malice.
Malice and forethought, or just malice?
Just malice, pure malice. So we'll find out who that is when we come back from this short break here on the Retirement and IRA Show. Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show.
You're playing the music pot. I mean, the singing pot.
It goes along for a while before there's words, Jim. And we heard the words a couple weeks ago, so this has been number one for quite some time.
All right.
You want to do it? There we go. Got the only word in there we need, right?
Yes.
So, Jim, that's your favorite song. What's the name of that
song? I would say it's my favorite song, but I knew it was David Bowie fame.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. That was only 40 years ago instead of 80 years ago. Actually, the previous one was more like 110 years ago.
Right, because so it was written in 1905. Actually, it was written when our office was built.
Oh.
Original part of our office was built in 1905 by W.T. Early.
Hmm. Oh, that was pretty early.
That was fascinating.
No pun intended.
Yes. Oh, no intended.
By the way, there was someone from the the Fort Collins Historical Board or something investigating the house when you were gone last week. We forgot to tell you. If
what?
That makes you a little bit nervous.
Over what?
She was going around commenting on how it doesn't look at all like the historical representation of the home that should be sitting on this property.
Okay, first of all, I wasn't out last week. Second of all,
no,
you're a terrible liar.
Would you like to double check with Deb?
I wasn't out last week.
You left earlier than the rest of us who were working right to the end. And she happened to be in here and was wandering around commenting on how the windows don't look right. And
too bad they approved it.
I know. I think she was saying she should have been stricter.
Oh, well, too bad.
I agree.
We still have the original windows on the west side of the house. That's why it's so rickety and cold on that side of the office. What more do they want? Do you want to take the windows out?
It's called nostalgic.
Okay. You know, this from a city that touts their greenliness wouldn't let me replace windows that let more air through than Swiss cheese.
Seems like those two things are in conflict.
Yeah. I've never thought of Swiss cheese as being breezy.
Well, this from the same city that has outlawed fracking, but at the same time has painted on their natural gas-powered dump trucks, powered by clean natural gas. So talk about hypocritical or idiotic. That's what I have to say about Fort Collins.
They only use unfracked natural gas. the true organic natural
oh,
gas.
Oh, yes. Right. I mean, it makes me laugh. They outlaw fracking. Not that there's any fracking wells in Fort Collins anyways, but it makes our left-leaning government feel good that they accomplished something. And right on the dump trucks powered by clean natural gas. And, of course, they have that whole caterpillar-looking bus system that runs north and south, all powered by, quote-unquote, clean natural gas. Yet they also pat themselves on the back for outlawing the production of clean natural gas.
I wonder if there's electric garbage trucks.
I don't know. So if she has a problem with my windows, she can go pound tar.
She might have been in here to try to do business with you, but I don't know.
I don't think so.
Not anymore. Okay. Anyway.
She was just in here to complain.
The place was built 4 years ago. If they're complaining about the windows now.
I thought it was built in 1905.
The original cold part.
Oh, I see.
The new part has new windows
in it. The cozy warm part.
Yes. The warm part in the winter actually has insulation and very, very good windows. But Chris's office, convenient how that happened.
Yeah, I bring a coat.
Has all the original windows from W.T. Early's 1905 mm-hmm. years. I mean, you can literally hold, like, you know, one of those things you hold and it spins around?
Fan?
No.
Or a pinwheel?
Pinwheel.
You can hold a pinwheel in front of the windows and it'll spin.
Wow. That's kind of cool. I haven't tried that.
You're sitting there freezing, try it.
I'll give you something to do during the day.
Right.
Like you don't have anything else to do.
So, Peter, you brought up a good point towards the end of the last segment that Jim asked a question or made a comment about a partnership plan, which refers to a type of LTC policy, a long-term care insurance
policy. Right. I don't want to spend too much time.
Aren't universally
available.
So this is something else that varies.
Some states
have
them, some states don't. Colorado does. Right. What I don't want to spend too much time on partnership plans. States have to adopt the partnership program so it will work. But in short, what a partnership plan will allow someone to do is purchase a pool of coverage, let's say $500,000. I'll just pick that number out of thin air. And if that particular person uses all $500,000 of benefit for their care, and now they have to go into spending their assets or their income, and if they are now in the process of spending their own assets, it will allow them, Jan, to shield $500,000 of assets where otherwise, because of the asset test, they would have to spend those assets. It would allow them to shield those assets and still get Medicaid eligibility. Is that
That's right, assessment? Because without a partnership plan, the community spouse could have, in what are called countable resources, $119,220 plus the $2,000 that the applicant or the Medicaid recipient could have, for a total of $121,220. And in your hypothetical, that couple, after having exhausted the partnership benefit of $500,000, could still shelter and be eligible for Medicaid a total of $620,000. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they still get the
and be eligible
assets,
for Medicaid.
Exclusion, if that's the right
asset
word,
test.
That remains protected plus the amount from the partnership.
Correct. Perfect.
Oh, I didn't realize it was in addition to. That's interesting to know.
Correct. So that's the benefit of a partnership policy. And as we write an LTC policy, again, I don't want to get into it. We covered it on another show. Partnership policies have to have certain elements to them in order to be partnership qualified. A lot of the new hybrid LTC policies that are very popular are not partnership qualified. So that can become an issue if people are looking to guarantee an inheritance. To me, that's where it's a big issue. If you're looking to be able to guarantee an inheritance to someone, then the partnership plan could be a benefit. Or if you're looking to protect the community spouse, you're looking to make sure that the healthy spouse, so to speak, is going to be able to maintain more than a house, a car, and $120,000, these types of policies can come in very handy. But back to the income part now, that we were talking about.
Right. I think your question was what counts as income? Right.
Correct.
Everything
but an LTC payment.
Right. And then there's some other things that also are exempted from income. If there are annuity payments, as I recall, if there are annuity payments coming off of a reverse mortgage, meaning that the monthly payments coming off of the reverse mortgage, my recollection is that will not
I believe
count.
It is a protected asset as well, because a house is a protected asset.
Yep. Well, I don't know that they're linked that way, but I think the regulations provide that the reverse mortgage is any payments coming out of the reverse mortgage tool of that way of constructing mm-hmm. the asset are not going to be counted. But we have to be really careful also about thinking about pre-application income and post-eligibility income. But let's stick with pre-application income, because I think that's where you're headed. And I want to link the notion of income from any source with assets, because if we are truly with this $121,220 asset limit, countable resource limit, if there is an income-producing asset that produces that income with the applicant's name on the check, as Peter said just a little bit ago, then that will count. But when we as income. But when we do the planning, frequently what happens is that what you all have helped your clients do, which is build their resources, what we end up doing is tearing apart those resources for the purpose of spending down to Medicaid eligibility limits. So when I told you earlier that what I try to leave these folks who come in the door who are anxious because they're in crisis and because $8,000-$9,000 a month is going out the door for long-term care expenses, nursing home expenses, when they're worried about being a burden on others and whether or not they're going to be able to leave something to their family, what we can do is save up to half of their countable resources in a safe place, and then utilize a tool, not an investment, but a tool that happens to be called an annuity, to pump up income, whether it's the community spouse's income, the well spouse's income, or the sick spouse's income, if it's below these high limits. And again, in Larimer and Weld County, that limit is $7,286 a month. Most of the regular folks, the middle class folks that you probably come across, or at least that come into my office, do not have this kind of income. Mm. And most of the time, we're looking at folks whose income tops out at around $4,000 or $5,000 in the applicant spouse's name. So these higher regional limits, with the use of a Miller Trust or an income trust, the Utah Gap Trust that you talked about just a moment ago, the difference between actual income and these high regional income limits presents a planning opportunity for mm-hmm. us, where we can move assets to a safe place, take, and this is called half a, in the industry, in the estate planning, Medicaid planning world, the term given to this strategy is called half a loaf type planning. It doesn't matter that we're on the radio talking about this. Medicaid knows about this. We submit a lot of applications, which they readily, you know, analyze certainly and accept with this planning technique. So I know I've run you around the racetrack here, but what we may end up doing with a client who comes in the door with $400,000 in countable resources, over and in excess of the $121,000 that they can keep. So we've got $500,000 in change for these folks coming in the door. We put their community spouse resource allowance, that roughly $121,000, off to the side. That's what the community spouse can keep in his or her own name. The remainder is what we call excess. And if it's roughly $400,000, the half a loaf type plan works by gifting off roughly half of the excess resources to a safe place and then converting the rest of the excess resources into an income stream through the use of a, not an investment, but a tool, a Medicaid compliant annuity that can either pump up the applicant spouse's income to the income eligibility limit, and again in Larimer County that's $7,286, or depending on the age and the appropriate circumstances of the well spouse, we may be able to have that annuity pay out to her.
Now, why would you want to pump up the income of the person going into assisted living?
Well, I think I can summarize what Jan just said for people, because I learned a lot by what she just said, but it was a little bit hard for, I think, most people to follow. And I think the summary is people are far more likely to be rejected for these Medicare benefits because of the resources or asset test than because of the income test. So this is a technique to trade some of these resources or assets for income instead. So instead of just losing them completely, you at least maintain, you trade them in for something that's
but
going to
my
fall
question
of
would
under
be,
this other
if
limit.
Somebody has $1,500 a month of income, and then we do, or you help the family do one of these strategies, and you pump that up to $5,000 now a month of income, they get to, they being the institutionalized spouse, gets to keep all $5,000, and Medicaid will pay for them.
What you're missing is the third question that Medicaid asks on the Medicaid application. The first question is, are you sick? The second question is, are you poor? And we're in the midst of discussing what does poor mean? Income test, resource test. The third question is, have you given away anything of value within the last 5 years prior to applying for Medicaid? Because if you have, Medicaid says, we think you did that just so you could get on Medicaid, and we're not buying it. What we will do is total up the amount of the gifts that you have made within the last 5 years, and we're going to compute how many months of nursing home care you could have purchased with that, for example, $70,000 gift. And under the current way that Medicaid determines that penalty period, it'd be roughly 10 months. Mm-hmm. So the reason that we are pumping up the applicant spouse's income with the money coming in from this Medicaid compliant annuity is because there's going to be a period of eligibility after we apply for Medicaid. There's going to be a period of ineligibility because of the gifting we did to get them spent down to the resource limit. So for example, again, using this $400,000 too much, we're going to gift off $200,000 to a safe place. The remaining $200,000 too much is going to be placed into this Medicaid compliant annuity, a single premium immediate annuity that begins paying out next month. And it's going to help the applicant pay the private cost of care while the period of ineligibility or the penalty is running.
Gotcha.
For having made
now
the gift.
On these annuities.
So my summary was a little off of the intent. It's partially what I said, but I missed the piece about covering the ineligible
right.
periods.
You just put the bridge out for me. That's all. I mean, that was a fine summary because typically it isn't the income limit that is the stumbling block. It isn't the medical test that is the stumbling block. It's the resource test
right.
that's the stumbling block.
Got it.
And so what we utilize are Medicaid's own rules to basically accelerate a person's eligibility for Medicaid benefits.
So you intentionally created an eligible period, but at least you get to gift off half of it, and then you self-fund to cover the ineligible period. But at least instead of losing it all, you've only lost half of it.
on the nose, Chris. That's on the nose. And the benefit there then is that we are caring for the elder in a safe place. Mm-hmm. No big red M is put on their forehead because they are on Medicaid.
And they're private pay, so they get a better bed in a better location.
Maybe so. Plus, they just get priority in that institution for
Absolutely.
Having been private pay before they went on Medicaid.
Exactly.
And then we also have met the elders' other worry about potentially leaving something for their kids because we have these other half of the excess funds over in a safe place.
So I got a couple of things I want to run with on this. The first thing on the Medicaid annuities, what we want to make sure people understand is the ultimate beneficiary is Medicaid. The beneficiary of those annuities, from my understanding, Medicaid has to be as a named beneficiary.
Absolutely. They have to be the primary death beneficiary, but the applicant will exhaust the annuity before one dime is spent on their care by Medicaid. So what we have is a really nice balance between the amount gifted, the amount placed in this Medicaid annuity, the calculation of the period of ineligibility or the penalty period that runs for having made the gift, and then the annuity is exhausted by the time the penalty has run out.
But my mind is always thinking. So one of the issues we run into when we buy single premium immediate annuities is the purchaser will say, okay, I'm going to put $200,000 in this annuity and I'm going to get hit by a bus tomorrow and the insurance company keeps all $200,000. Can these Medicaid, so to overcome that, we will look at cash refunds or installment refunds or some type of refund provision rider that we can add to the annuity that says if the applicant to the annuity, and I'm talking a non-Medicaid single premium immediate annuity, if the applicant dies after receiving just $100,000 of the $200,000 they put in, their beneficiary will get the $100,000. Is it okay to have that provision on a Medicaid annuity or they don't care?
Depends, I guess, on the length of the annuity. The other part of being a Medicaid compliant annuity, Jim, is that it has to pay out during the life expectancy level term.
Mm-hmm.
And then Medicaid has to be the
beneficiary,
the primary death beneficiary.
But what I'm
perhaps
wondering,
you and I should explore this because I'm only aware of one insurance company in the nation that can typically work with me on a 2-year immediate payout. And this company has a broker that, you know, I kind of turn them loose with, and sometimes individual agents can help me out with this, but oftentimes I just have to turn the client loose with the broker and the use of this company called Employees Life Company in order to get the exact results that I need, which is we're going to apply for Medicaid today, having done the gifting that we need to do today, having placed the premium with the annuity company today, we apply for Medicaid, and then the following month, the penalty should start to run. So I need the payout from the annuity next month.
Right, and that's every single premium immediate annuity will let us begin taking income the following month. That's not the issue. What I'm just curious on is overcoming the person's objection perhaps to buying the annuity of, okay, I'm
going
to put...
Well, they know they're going in, though. This isn't... You're talking about a question where we don't know our situation. Here, they know their situation. They need to go into assisted living, nursing home care.
Right, but I'm just playing devil's advocate mm-hmm. here on wanting to give an inheritance to their children. They don't know, or at least I assume they don't know, am I going to live 1 month in assisted living or 14 years in assisted living? And if I'm going to live 1 month in assisted living, putting $200,000 mm-hmm. in an annuity that at my death 1 month later stays with the insurance company may not be appealing to them.
Right.
The secondary, I don't know if this adds to the conversation because I may not be understanding the product that you're thinking about very well, but the second death beneficiary is probably the spouse.
So let me interject here. Mm-hmm. In the Medicaid compliant annuity, let's say it runs for 2 years.
I die in the third month. Is there a death benefit that's payable to a beneficiary?
There is, yes.
Okay, so it is allowed. Okay, so if there's a death benefit, see, on an immediate annuity, it's annuitized. So the only way you can get a death benefit on an immediate annuity, unlike a deferred annuity, which has an account value, is to have an installment refund or a cash refund option. That's the only way they pay a death benefit. If you want to maximize income, you have no death benefit on an immediate annuity because it lets you play mortality credits. Take the chance that, hey, if I live a long time, I'm going to get more money. But if I die, well, the insurance company keeps the money.
So the distinction here is you're thinking in terms of financial
planning yes.
and growth. And where I'm at is pulling it
Correct.
Back and tearing it apart.
Well, it's just when I'm just listening to how you describe it. If someone's going into a nursing home or an assisted living, let's say they had a stroke and they need complete help because they're partially paralyzed, we don't know what their life expectancy is. And as an agent or a broker trying to help a client, if they're going to put $200,000, $300,000 in an annuity, I have to deal with beneficiaries afterwards that say, well, that was a stupid thing to do. Mom lived a month.
Absolutely.
And $300,000 is gone. We're suing you.
We're on the same page because I don't advocate annuities for my older clients. And this is why I chose my words really carefully, that we aren't investing in this annuity. We are placing money in this annuity to cover the cost of private care while the Medicaid penalty or period of ineligibility is running. That is all it is.
This is not an off-the-shelf annuity, Jim.
An off-the-shelf annuity. Absolutely, I know that.
And only one company, according to Jan, offers it. So this is not something that someone has an annuity they can convert to this or change. This
no,
is
and
one
I
source.
Would want to caution our listeners, do not run out and stop putting mom or dad's money in an annuity thinking you're protecting them for Medicare eligibility. You're not.
Thanks for saying that, because that can be a disaster. An absolute disaster.
You have to work with someone like Jan. You have to work with someone who's knowledgeable in Medicaid annuities. And even though I don't particularly use Medicaid annuities in my practice, I have heard there are upwards of 3 companies nationwide that offer them. So I could try to do some research for you to see if there's other companies.
Super.
But interesting. When we come back, I know we're going to lead in with the number one song in America 35 years ago. But I want to... we are, right?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
we want to begin, and I want to talk, Jan, in situations of the income test with the... I'll explain. Something with the income test. I got to try to figure out what I'm trying to ask.
Okay.
All about the income.
All about the income. So when we come back from this short break, we'll be hearing the number one song this week in 1980. It was a song that was inspired by the band Chic. Chic was the same group that wrote our previous 4 weeks top hit, Upside Down.
Oh.
So it's all about the Chic.
Oh, okay.
So we'll come back when we'll find out what... That was actually a good teaser there. So the hints are getting better. We'll have to tell our hint generation.
Who is that, Deb, or is that Tina?
I think Tina's putting these together.
Tina's She's doing a fine job.
Fine job.
Fine
now.
Job.
So we'll be back right after the short break with the Retirement and IRA Show. Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. Very identifiable tune there. Jim got it right away. That is Another One Bites the Dust by Queen. Number one song, up from number 3 last week. Well, last week in 1980, that is. And this song was inspired by the song Good Times, written by the disco group Chic, who had also written Upside Down, the Diana Ross tune that was number one for two, three weeks prior to this. So they're... kind of in the back room dominating the charts, apparently. They didn't write this song, but they certainly influenced it. If you go back and listen to that Good Times song, you can hear the beginning is very, very similar to Another One Bites the Dust. So this one is clearly not a disco tune, though, so they Queen did their own twist on it, right?
Exactly.
So this is the final segment of the Retirement and IRA Show. Hopefully you've been enjoying so far, at least benefiting from some information we haven't really talked about on the show before. So, Jim, where do you want to take us from here?
Well, what I want to do before, because off air we talked a lot about what I want to cover, and it's making me say, geez, we need to bring Jan back for another. And she will be here next week. That's one of the things I want to cover. She will be here next week live and in studio at KFKA. Take and listen as questions. I'm sure some of our listeners have a ton of questions for you, Jan, hopefully. And maybe we'll just bring you back for another recording in the future. But once again, if somebody wants to reach you in Colorado and they have some questions, they have some of these concerns with their family members, how do they go about reaching you?
Phone number for the office in Berthoud is 970-532-4183. We'd welcome their call.
Okay, and why don't you give that one more time?
Sure, 970-532-4183.
Okay, and as always, any listener, whenever we have a guest on here, you can always reach out to my office. Longtime listeners will know our website is Jim Helps. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Click on the Contact Us button. A little box opens up, and you can just type a message in that box, click Submit, and it comes directly to us. And all that you have to write in that box is, how do I get a hold of Jan? And we will call you. Actually, you got to put your phone number too. And then, and your email address. That's the thing. If they don't put their email address, I got no way to get back a hold of them.
Right.
So make sure you put your email address, phone number, and how do I get a hold of Jan? And one of my staff members will get a hold of you and give you Jan's contact info. And Pete, of course, you are always available as well to consult with people. One of the things that I like to say about you, Pete, is your first meeting is complimentary. Yes. For those who don't know what that means, it's free, which is a rarity. You don't often hear that free with attorney. So it's a good chance for people to come in and pick your brain and get an understanding of estate planning.
Sure, and it's difficult. I don't think people ought to be charged to come in and find out what's needed and what it costs. So that's why I do that. And they need to make an assessment as to whether or not they want to proceed. But I'm with the law firm of Cohen, Payton, and Payne. You can reach me at 970-339-3500. That's 970-339-3500. Work in the area of estate planning, business transactions, and business succession. Also reach me at peterscotthelps.com. That's Peter, S-C-O-T-T-H-E-L-P-S.com. They can reach me there. That'll put them directly into our webpage. So
perfectly. And for any of our iTunian listeners, could they reach out to you and maybe get referrals of attorneys maybe in their state that you guys may know of or have a list of qualified attorneys? Is that possible?
Absolutely. And Jan belongs to a number of organizations that specialize, or attorneys around the country belong to, that work with people in the elder law area. And she also has access to estate planning attorneys, as I do, through our various networks.
Perfect. So if anybody's listening to us off of iTunes and is saying, wow, these people sound brilliant, I'd love to talk to them, but I'm not a Colorado resident and they may not have passed the bar in my state, still reach out to us because they may be able to refer somebody in your state who at least has the training and knowledge to be in the groups and organizations that these two fine attorneys belong to, and maybe they can help you. And then finally, for those who want to work with Chris and I, we are practicing financial planners, or at least I am. Chris is a practicing instructor of financial planning at Colorado State University, but you also work here in the office part-time assisting in a lot of the data entry of our retirement plans. So we are available to work with clients. So if anybody wants to consult with us, we offer what we call a coffee and a second opinion. It's a little twist on an old thing. But what we do when you come to our Fort Collins office, you'll notice, Pete, because you're drinking a cup of coffee,
yes,
we have a plethora, a cornucopia, a huge amount of these little pods, little Keurig pods,
right.
I guess they call them.
Yeah, very
and,
good, too.
For every conceivable fetish of coffee you may have, we probably have a pod for that. If we don't, we'll get one. But there's every flavor and type of... Do you see the new ones? They're not... Do you see the pods out there that are screen?
They're screen?
Yeah, they're not all in plastic anymore because it's not green. So they have this... it really looks weird. It's got
like a fabric.
Yeah, it's a fabric
mesh thing down there.
Mm-hmm. Oh. And the coffee moves around in it, but it's supposed to be better for the environment, I guess. I don't know. Instead of those plastic
things.
Those
are aren't those the ones not by Green Mountain, the monopoly that is K-Cups?
I have no idea. But I was asking
them. So you're serving people knockoff K-Cups now?
I was asking them the other day, what the heck is this? And it's better for the environment. It's a mesh. But I haven't had one of the coffees yet because it's decaf, and I don't drink decaf.
Oh, I'll have to look for that because I drink decaf in the afternoons.
Oh, well, we've got
try that.
A ton of them, so make the mesh decaf and let us know how it is.
Do you have a pod that already contains the Baileys?
No, but if you look in the cabinet under the Keurig,
yeah.
Who wants to be limited to Baileys in there?
Oh, well, I'll be partaking of coffee momentarily then.
You knew I had the Baileys. Well, it's not Baileys, it's St. Brennan and it's...
Oh, that's good enough in coffee. I'm not too picky.
Yeah.
Okay.
Especially at that price.
Yeah, exactly.
one pod just wouldn't do it.
No, true. True.
So it's in there. So I do have some under.
Excellent. Well, thanks
for
the
look
update.
In there. No problem.
So you now. Let's get this show over with. So I can...
See, that way you could have a pod and a beer. Right. A shot and a beer.
But anyways, if anybody wants to work with us, we call it what we call a coffee and a second opinion. And it gives you an opportunity to come into the office, meet with us, have one of our cups of coffee. And I guess, I don't know, we're allowed to put a shot of Baileys in that or not. But I'm sure compliance will tell me now.
Compliance is probably okay with it. However, law enforcement here is not.
What do they care?
I'm just telling you, it's not allowed.
Oh, really? I can't put it. So you can't have a shot of Baileys?
I can as an employee, but we can't give it to our customers.
Really?
Really.
What if I fire you?
Then I can't have the Baileys anymore.
So as soon as you pick up that Baileys, I'm going to scream, "You're fired." And when you put the Baileys down, I'm going to say, "You're hired."
No, if you do that, I'm taking the Baileys and leaving.
I did not know that, so we cannot give our listeners a shot of Baileys.
Correct.
But I could sit there drinking.
You could get
Baileys.
A liquor license and then be able to do that.
No,
but without it,
that.
Then you get in trouble.
So no shot of Baileys, people, but you can watch Chris put a shot of Baileys in his coffee.
That might be worth the
that's
price
worth
of
the
admission.
Price of admission right there.
Wow.
So, but we digress. Yeah.
Yes. So anyways, we do want to extend that. If anybody wants to schedule a coffee and a second opinion, we do not charge for that initial meeting. It gives you a chance to come in, talk to us about your IRAs, your 401k, Social Security, your retirement, maybe our secure retirement income process. Just gives you a better understanding of where you are today and where you may want to be tomorrow and whether or not we can help you or not. We don't know if we can help everybody out there. That's part of why Peter and I still meet with people the old-fashioned way. And for you iTunians listeners, we can do all this, or at least my office can, do all this right over the internet. We've had people in many states reach out to us, and we can hold the coffee and a second opinion discussion right over the phone. Now, the only trade-off is they don't get to see me, and number two, they have to make their own coffee. But we're willing to mail you the actual pod, none of the Baileys, of course, but the pod. I would assume we can mail this new cloth pod, too. And you can make your own coffee on us.
They have to own a machine as well.
They do. We're not going to provide the Keurig. And no iTunian listener has ever taken us up on the mailed pod offer.
They will now.
They will now because someone's out there listening. All right, mail me a pod. I'm going to talk to you. But anyway, so all that can be found on Jim Helps. That's JimHelps.com. Okay, Jan. You are going to be here next week. You are going to be taking listeners' questions. So if anybody has questions for Jan, especially on Medicaid eligibility, some of the asset tests, some of the income test, what I want to do is start talking to you in the last 20 or so minutes that we have really about issues that I run into.
Sure.
On a regular basis in the office. And I want to describe some of the situations that I see on a far too regular basis and why I try to get a lot of people who come in, whether it's for a coffee and a second opinion, whether it's just a caller to the show, or someone who is actually hired to work with my firm, some of the importance and benefits of long-term care insurance. I'm not looking to turn this into an LTC discussion. Instead, what I want to do is point out to people some of the weaknesses that they may be subject to and not realize. And the first is that I see all too often is one spouse. It's usually the gentleman, but it's not all the time, worked their entire career. And the other spouse may have been staying at home and taking care of children, which anyone will admit is probably a tougher job than the gentleman who was at work working. But the way retirement planning works, no pun intended, the worker amasses all the assets. And they tend to amass all the assets inside what we call a qualified retirement account, usually a 401k, 403b, 457, TSP, whatever the case may be. So let's talk hypothetically, Jan, about perhaps someone who worked and amassed $1 million. I'm just using that as a round number. Could be 100,000, could be 4 million. Let's just say $1 million. But the stay-at-home spouse who raised the children or cared for family members or did other things doesn't have any meaningful assets in his or her name. For the case of this example, let's just say the husband worked, the wife stayed at home, so we can use the his and her pronouns. So she stayed at home, and she doesn't have much assets in her name. She would be entitled to some Social Security benefit, correct, Chris?
Possibly, depending on if she has her own work record or if she's qualified for spousal benefits.
Let's just say she stayed at home with spousal benefits, exactly.
On her husband's work record.
Mm-hmm. So let's just assume the spouse did pay, the working spouse paid into Social Security. So the stay-at-home spouse is entitled to a Social Security benefit. Let's just say it's $1,000 a month. That would be half of the worker spouse's PIA. Okay, here's the thing that scares me greatly on
Well, before this. You get to the scare, if she's the one who develops the issue and needs the assistance in the nursing facility and has the Medicaid question, that falls really under some of the discussion that we've previously had. So Jim's now going to put a twist on it, and it's not the wife that has very few assets that's going in, but rather...
Right, because let's carry on with what you're saying. So Jan, first... Let's just assume the spouse, the female, the wife, needed the assistance. We have $1 million in a 401k, and let's say the gentleman retires and moves it to an IRA. It doesn't matter whether it's in a 401k or an IRA. So he has $1 million in a retirement account. She has $1,000 of Social Security. He has $2,000 of Social Security. Let's just say he turned his on at 66 as well. She needs assistance. Let's say she has a stroke and she is now paralyzed, totally incapable of taking care of herself. She needs the assistance. Without getting into specifics, there is a lot of planning you can do in that situation to protect that $1 million IRA.
Absolutely, because if you go through the three questions that Medicaid would ask if she applied for Medicaid, the first question is she sick? And the answer is yes. Is she poor? If we look first at her income, she is well within the lower threshold of the income limits and wouldn't even need at $1,000 a month the income trust that we had been talking about.
Right, because it's only $2,199 is the income limit, and she's only $1,000 of income. She's well below.
Yep. Now we look at the resource test, which again is where most folks stumble in looking at Medicaid. And if what we have over on the well spouse or the husband's side is a $1 million IRA, then we've got a problem. And the problem can be quickly resolved through what happened a couple of years ago with a change in the Medicaid regulations for allowing what are called community spousal annuities.
And this is different than the previous annuity we talked
Absolutely.
About.
Absolutely. Okay. Very, very different.
This is to protect the community spouse, the healthy one, the guy who's got the $1 million in an
right.
IRA.
So depending on his age and other factors related to his own personal circumstances, which I would rely a lot on a financial planner to help us course through, and a CPA if needed. But assuming that all of the stars line up correctly, that he's not too advanced in age, that his own health is pretty good, and that other things look pretty solid for him, then we could convert that $1 million IRA into a Medicaid-compliant community spouse annuity. We could do that this month and apply for Medicaid for the wife, and probably have her qualified beginning the next month.
Well, let's just assume the gentleman was 70, a 70-year-old gentleman now applying. Would this Medicaid annuity for the community spouse have to be joint and survivor or just in his name?
Just in his name.
Okay.
However, the kicker.
Medicaid is the beneficiary.
Medicaid is the beneficiary for any expenses that she incurs.
Correct. So at his passing.
Yeah. Yes. So if she receives Medicaid benefits for 5 years, and if you do the math, Medicaid's going to be spending $8,000 a month and picking up the nursing home bill for 5 years. There's a tidy amount there. At his death, Medicaid gets to be paid back first.
Right. There's no way to have your cake and eat it too. But what we're simply trying to say is that gentleman with the $1 million, if he didn't buy the income annuity, he would be forced to spend his $1 million down taking care of his wife. Either way, he's going to pay the money. He's either going to pay it during life or at death, if there's any money left.
If there's any money deaths left. So the roll of the dice is how long is he going to live?
Exactly.
And is he going to have any fun?
Uh-huh. Right. Right.
So what I'm trying to say is in this hypothetical example, he is 70. He could get a payout of about 7.3% on a typical SPIA. So let's just assume $1 million goes in, and we wouldn't advocate all million. I would probably leave the 120,000 exemption amount he's allowed out. But he could generate somewhere around $60,000-$65,000 a year of income. And I do know in a Medicaid annuity, you can have a cost of living adjustment built into that. So he could have payments that increase. He can't have a lump sum balloon payment or anything like that, but he could have a standard COLA adjustment payment built in. So it might pay him $50,000 a year going up at COLA or something like that.
And the only thing we want to be careful about is putting another hat on and thinking about his Medicaid eligibility at some point.
Absolutely.
So we want to keep him within reach if he needed Medicaid.
And that's
himself.
Where I'm going with this, because I want to turn the tide now. That is the easy situation. The situation where this gets difficult, and the reason it's quote-unquote easy, the asset, the $1 million is in a qualified account. Most middle Americans have the majority of their assets, Chris, you'll agree, in qualified accounts. They have it in IRAs, 401ks, 403bs, TSPs. They save their entire life. They've been primed and pumped by the way our retirement system works to fill these qualified accounts. There's one unique rule with a qualified account, Chris, and that is they cannot be held
jointly.
Exactly. So the issue becomes, let's turn the tides here, Jan. Same situation. Wife stayed at home. She's collecting $1,000 Social Security benefit. Husband worked. He's collecting $2,000 in Social Security and has $1 million IRA. He has the stroke. He's 70. She's 70 as well. He married the same age. He has the stroke now. Now, does she have the ability to do much of what you described?
Not at all.
Not at all. That's the issue. And the issue becomes the ownership of the asset. By law, that IRA in the institutionalized or the sick spouse's name, the gentleman who just had the stroke, cannot be transferred during life to the wife.
So the real problem is yes, we could cash out that IRA, and then we have her ability to do whatever she needs to with it. But the income tax consequences of cashing out that IRA could scotch the deal.
Could take 35% to 50% of it, depending on the state they live in and what could happen.
So let me qualify my not at all with. Our options get narrower with those kinds of assets that aren't nearly as flexible as a joint non-qualified account.
If it was a joint account, which could be transferred ownership easily and legally, planning opportunities. Listeners, people, this is what I'm trying to get at, because I see this all the time. Whether you're an iTunian listening off of iTunes in Belarus, or happen to be an American citizen, or listen to us in Colorado and New York City. When you get into a situation where one spouse has most of the assets in qualified accounts, please explore long-term care insurance at the very least on that spouse. At the very least. I prefer it on both. But if you had long-term care insurance, especially, Jan, a partnership plan where you might buy a $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 partnership plan, now those assets from the IRA need to be spent down, yes, to provide for the care, but not until the partnership plan has paid out. And if you have a $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 partnership plan and the spouse now with the stroke uses all that, the community spouse will be allowed to protect $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 of that IRA for themselves.
That's it.
Which you couldn't do in the other scenario.
Not without some penalty and
income
tax.
Huge penalties, huge taxes, inflexibility. When we see this, we try to warn, and oftentimes, Pete, because we're men, all three of us here are men except for Jan, she's a woman. But men...
And there's four of us.
Thank you.
You know, there's three men. I said all three of us are men, yeah. Except for Jan. She's a woman.
Thanks for that, because I was wondering about
thanks
that.
Thanks for pointing that out. Mm-hmm. There we go.
But what I'm getting at, men, we tend to be, Jan, you'll agree, stubborn at times.
What?
And I have seen this where my own two eyes, where the gentleman with the million-dollar IRA will say, nothing's going to happen to me. I am not going to let myself go into a nursing home. I've heard this before. I'll kill myself. And I say to them, well, what if you had a stroke and you couldn't pick up the gun? And I tell the
that's
wife...
That's kind of a morbid comment.
That's what I say. And then I'll look at the wife, though, and I will say, though, it's not for him, it's for you that I'm recommending the long-term care insurance. He's the one with the stroke or the Alzheimer's or the dementia. He doesn't know what's going on. You do. And all your money is going to go to take care of him, which is fine, but leaves you nothing. And that's what I'm trying to get our listeners to understand. If there's, I prefer both spouses try to embrace long-term care planning to avoid Medicaid. That would be the best way. But if you can't, in disparity of income situations or disparity of asset ownership where it's owned in qualified accounts and cannot be transferred without huge tax implications, you really need to explore long-term care. Okay. Jan, thank you very much for coming in.
What a pleasure. Thank you very much. I've had a good time.
We did too. Pete, you
yep.
like it?
And let's not forget next week, Jan's going to be
here.
Live with
yes.
us in studio mm-hmm. to take your calls and answer all your questions.
And drink your coffee.
And yes. drink, well, no, because we'll be at KFKA, not here.
Bring my own coffee.
Bring yes. your own. Yeah, KFK don't have coffee. But,
well, they have something they call coffee there.
Not good stuff.
No, that's what I'm saying. They call it coffee, but
yeah, I wouldn't drink it, put it that way. But we will see everybody next. We're not seeing, but listen, everybody next week. If you have questions, give us a call. We will be live. Jan will be with us. And Jan, I'd love to have you back on another show because there's still so many questions I'd love to cover with you.
Yep. There's even another benefit we haven't even talked about, which is through the Veterans Administration, which
okay.
we know we're a little anxious, but mm-hmm. there's a Veterans Administration pension benefit for certain veterans that are also another asset that we, or another benefit that we might use for long-term care
well,
plan.
Well, we definitely have to have Jan back then,
yeah,
Chris.
We'll definitely have her back if we haven't annoyed her too much. So thanks, everybody, for listening once again today on the Retirement and IRA Show. We'll be back next week with a live show. Go out and have yourself a great day.
Like what you just heard? Missed some of today's show? Listen again on iTunes or the Retirement and IRA Show.com.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.